You're listening to Worldlink. In Bonn, I'm Kate Laycock.
And I'm Neil King. Now, for the first time on Worldlink, we're going to be spending the first half of the show in the company of just one person. And there's a special reason for that.
In the Christian part of the world, it's Christmas, and Christmas is a time for storytelling. There's the story which started it all, the Bible's tale of a baby born into poverty but worshipped by angels. And then there are the stories which we tell to one another when we're gathered together with friends and family. The stories which perhaps weren't originally stories at all, but experiences. Things which have shaped us and which suddenly, maybe because of the wine and the food, maybe because of the cold outside, or maybe because of the emotion of the occasion, we feel the need to share. So, this Christmas, we've decided to tell you just such a story. It's not our story, though. It's Isaac Mugabe's.
Isaac is a journalist working for DW's Africa Link programme. And earlier this week, he and Kate sat down for a chat over coffee in the DW cafeteria. And he started to tell her his Christmas story.
It's a story which takes place in Kigali, the capital of his native Rwanda. It's 1994, Isaac is 17 years old, and his country has just witnessed one of the most horrific genocides in recent history.
Between April and July in that year, almost 20% of the country's population has been wiped out in the mass organised slaughter known as the Rwandan genocide.
So that's the horrific backdrop. But Isaac's story is, like all the best Christmas stories, one of hope and forgiveness against all odds. When I heard it, I asked him to come to the studio to share it with Neil and with you, the listeners.
So here is Isaac Mugabe with his tale of Christmas 1994 in Kigali.
Well, at Christmas time, we are trying to recover from the scars of the genocide, or the wounds, let me say the wounds, because they hadn't healed perfectly well. But of course, we are trying to come up, you know, build up a new life away from the tragedy. And in mind, of course, we had Christmas coming on and we couldn't drive our minds back to April, or between April and July.
So what happened between April and July 1994 in Rwanda?
Yeah, I could say it was the streams of blood flowing, you know, around across the country. There was a genocide taking place. A particular group of people, the Hutus, killing the Tutsis. And in just 100 days, 1 million people were dead.
Almost 20% of the Rwandan population
died
in that genocide.
That is true, exactly, yeah. So eventually it was stopped in July, on July 4th, and people started reconstructing their lives afresh, you know. So by Christmas time, it was only 3 months away from the actual healing, from August.
Mm. Can you give us an idea of the dynamics of this conflict? I mean, there was an ethnic element, there was a religious element. Can you perhaps describe that an outsider understands why these two groups clashed so savagely?
Well, the history, it goes back to 1959 when the first genocide actually took place, you know, when the colonial masters thought that they could divide Rwandans along their ethnic lines, and they thought one group, that is the Tutsis, were making themselves kings and, you know, superior above the Hutus. So there was a kind of revolution. To be so brief, because, you know, delving so much, it would take us a whole day here. And eventually, in the 90s, when a particular group, that is the Tutsis, who had been kicked out of the country, thought they could come back, you know, to their motherland, the Hutus in the country thought otherwise. They thought the country only belonged to them and no one else. And they regarded the Tutsis as foreign invaders, not as Rwandans, you know. So eventually, the rebel movement, which were predominantly the Tutsis, took over the country. The climax of everything was April 6th. When the plane carrying the head of state was shot down by unknown elements up to now. And so, as a revenge, the Hutus decided to embark on a killing spree, systematic killing spree. It wasn't prompted by the plane crash, but rather they had been trained and prepared for this by, among other people, the French.
Hmm. Yeah. What's your ethnic background?
Well, at the moment, we don't normally want to talk about ethnicity anymore. It's no longer a comfortable question to us, because as part of reconciliation, we prefer calling all ourselves as Rwandans, or defining ourselves as Rwandans, not along ethnic lines. So even if you went to the country right now, nobody will be ready to tell you that whether I'm a Tutsi or Hutu, because to some of us, it doesn't make sense. Yeah, we're all one people.
Well, this is a Christmas story, Isaac. And against all odds, it's a Christmas story with a message of hope and reconciliation. I want to come to that very shortly. But just in order so that people can understand quite the power of what it is that's happening this Christmas 1994, I want to just stay in that period that begins in April. Where are you? What's happening to you at this time?
I was lucky enough in April. I wasn't in the country. I was in neighboring Uganda because I was born a refugee. My parents fled the first genocide of 59. So I was born and raised in Uganda. But then 1994, when the killing started, I was in the country, but rather May, so I was in the country across the border.
So you're 17 at the time, and you're hearing stories of what's going on around you. And we've got a period of fear. What's it feel like at that time?
Yeah, it is indescribable, because you could imagine whether some people are really people or even not even animals, because animals at least are kind, you know. People had to pay money to be killed with bullets other than the machetes. I wonder whether you get that. Paying for your own death to be shot dead with the hope that that is a silent death rather than being chopped up.
And this is men, women, children?
Children and men, you know. Children were slammed, you know, against walls. And these are mothers who are doing this, and fathers. And sometimes, because to even to end beyond madness, a parent who, you know, in Africa we have intermarriages. So possibly you find a man, he's a Hutu, and the wife is a Tutsi. So the man could choose the kids who look like him. They are saved. Those who look like the mom, he kills them off. And vice versa.
Mm-hmm. You're 17 when this is happening.
Yep.
And you've just come out of the seminary. You wanted to be a priest.
I wanted
when
to
you
be a priest, true.
3 months after the genocide ends, it's Christmas. Now, the Catholic Church has played a role.
A big role.
Tell us about that.
During the genocide, most people or many people sought sanctuary to the church or in churches. They ran to churches with the hope that they would survive. One thing in the minds they knew, of course, no one can attack a holy place. But they were wrong. They were attacked in these places after tip-off by the parish priests or the evangelists who are in charge of those parishes. So it's like you call, people come, you know, you'll be protected. After the church is full, they call the militias. And in the blink of an eye, they're all dead.
And why did they do that?
To be honest, as when you look at, or when you read about what men of God are supposed to be doing, they were supposed to be doing the opposite, to protect them, you know. But I can't describe what was going in their minds, to be honest, you know. Whether even now they are remorseful of what they did, it's too hard to describe, because it was hatred beyond hatred, you know, hatred of humankind, that you can never find a definition for it. I think even the word genocide is too small for what happened.
Did you go to church that Christmas?
I went, but I'm not so quite sure whether I followed the service to the end, because many things were going on in my head, you know, whether I'm in the right place at the right time or whether I should be somewhere else. I went.
What was it like in the church? What sort of atmosphere was there?
It was really a difficult time for so many people. The scars of the genocide were still visible. And to a certain extent, people could see some of the people killed who participated in killing their families. So you can just imagine, I'm seated on the front pew or the front bench, and across I can see someone whose parents or relatives or himself who played an indirect role in the killing of my family. So it was a kind of suspicious look among esteemed people, whether in church or whether in bars in the evening or in the road, people treated others with suspicion.
And how did you feel looking at the men of God, as you put it, standing there preaching?
Initially, I thought they were kidding. They're not leading the service. But then I realized not everyone played a role in the genocide. Of course, there are those who objected to it and were killed, likewise, by their colleagues who happened to be priests or pastors. So I said, well, not everyone, you know, is a killer. But at the same time, listening to the sermon, you know, I thought it was a kind of reconciliation. But I thought it wasn't the right way or done by the right people to start preaching reconciliation, especially that many people were looking at them differently, even part of the congregation. They were not so sure whether they have the moral authority to preach to them.
Did you ever question your faith?
Yeah. I went and asked the priest, you know, every end of service, we have this kind of culture. You go, you handshake to the priest. And I asked him, do you think this place is still holy or it has to first be cleansed? Because that particular parish, the parish priest had not, you know, taken good care of the flock he was supposed to shepherd, let me put it that way, in the Christian language. He was part of the militia, the priest himself. Yeah, and until now he has been indicted for crimes, you know, genocide and other crimes against humanity. So I asked the priest whether the church itself has been cleansed of the blood shed in it. And it was like, well, this time of Christmas, we have to focus on the birth of Jesus Christ, that, you know, we can be looked at a high level, maybe by the Vatican. I don't think you are the right person to ask that question. I said, okay, well, I thought I, as a Christian or a Catholic for that matter, knowing what happened here 3 months ago or 4 months ago, maybe it should have gone through a cleansing ceremony, kind of. Yeah.
You went to two places that Christmas, Isaac, mm-hmm. looking for a sense of unity, looking for something which had been lost in your country. One of those places was church, and the other place was a club where you were DJing.
Yeah.
DJ Isaac, 17-year-old DJ
time,
Isaac.
Big time, mixing. Yeah. You get the beats, yeah?
We get the beats. So, tell us about that night. Was it Christmas Eve when you were DJing? When were you DJing?
Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
I went for the evening service. The day that, you know, gets us into Christmas, I DJed, you know.
So you went from the church to the club where you, as a 17-year-old, were booked as the Christmas Eve DJ.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you have female admirers following you from the church to the dance floor?
Men of them, yeah. Yeah. When you're a DJ and you don't have female admirers, then you're not a DJ. Yeah.
So take us to that night in the club, because, I mean, like in the church, you will have had victims and perpetrators together in one place, mm-hmm. dancing, celebrating, and you basically providing the music.
Mm-hmm.
How did that feel?
To me, it was one of the best experiences, because first of all, there were people celebrating victory of winning over the old regime that killed its own people. That was one. And of course, there were these other people who felt they're not part of that victory that is being, you know, talked about every now and then, but they were part of the partiers, although not really in the mood like others who are really overexcited. People felt some kind of relief saying, 100 days, 1 million people dead. So if it had continued, probably the whole population would have been, or Tutsi would have been dead. Now Christmas time was the best opportunity to celebrate that victory.
Did you have a feeling that the reconciliation was stronger in the club than in the church?
I think so, because probably I had a feeling whether, you know, when you're a DJ, you are kind of superimposed, you know, from the rest of the crowd. You actually see them from down. So you can read what exactly is going on, the chemistry that is going on among the partiers there, and know whether you are boring them or you're giving them the best, or they're not listening to the music, they're interested in, you know, making bonds with the opposite sex and vice versa, you know. But I thought people are connecting well in the club, but I had a strong feeling through music, everything can, you know, come from worse to better or to good, you know. Yeah.
Well, maybe it also had to do with your playlist. Can we talk about your playlist? Did you have a special playlist for that night?
I made sure that I do my research well to know what other clubs, you know, what kind of music they play, and to set pace. I always had particular music that my fans or the partiers will not listen anywhere else when they go to other clubs. Even though we had not more than 3 or 4 clubs operating, but I had special, you know, music and play, you know, playlists. So I said, I'm going to give it my best, you know. Work it up, non-stop, give them the rap they want, you know.
So as a DJ, you're up there looking down at everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have UN? The UN must have been around in UN.
The UN, yeah. The UN were around, you know, and they always loved that club, especially Sun City Club, where I played my music.
So you've got soldiers in the club?
We have them, mm-hmm. but not in combat.
Okay.
But of course, you know them, you know. The cars are parked outside and they have UNAMIL, United Nations Assistant Mission in Rwanda. The soldiers won't be actively participating in the dance, but rather watching to see the cutest girl in the house, you know. So, and I could, you know, try to bring them on the floor by just, you know, provoking them to come to the floor.
How did you provoke them?
With a rap, you know, to tell them, okay, well, we know they stood by when the genocide was taking place. They shouldn't stand by when the music is playing. I said, what the hell did you say? I said, come to the floor. Don't just watch over like you watched in April when people are being killed. And people say, ah, well done, boy.
And did they join and dance?
They joined in, you know, shyly. Shyly they could join in, you know, or let me say hypocritically, you know, they could join in. But of course, they liked the music and they liked the girls.
Can you give us some examples of the songs you played?
Snoopy Dogg Dog music, Gin and Juice. It has that bit like, rolling down the street, smoking and sipping and gin and juice.
Lay back with my mind on my money and my money on my mind. Rolling down the street, smoking and sipping on gin and juice. Lay back with my mind on my money.
And there is Hip Hop Hooray, yeah? Hip Hop Hooray.
Naughty by Nature?
Naughty by Nature.
So Hip Hop Hooray! Oh, hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. Smooth it out now.
And of course, my favorite was Shinehead, you know, because in that song, Try My Love, yeah? I used to like it so much. Actually, I loved it. I didn't like it. I loved it. Those are the lines of my playlists. Arrested Development, you know. In a circle, you know. I was so much into hip-hop. Yeah. To work out, you know, something energetic that gives you life when you are really mixing, you know. Yeah.
So to finish, Isaac, Christmas 1994, in Kigali, with you DJing, the spirit of that night, everybody dancing together, victims, perpetrators, UN soldiers...
Mm-hmm.
Did something of that night stay on in Kigali, in Rwanda?
Staying on, the way I understand it, was like to maintain the faith. Being a DJ, when I looked at the partiers, I say, well, if they could only go to church, it's Christmas time. And of course, celebrate, you know, the birth of Jesus Christ. Because in Rwanda, 80% are not only Christians, but Catholics. By then, we are Catholics. At least 1994. And what stayed on was the fact that I had to maintain my faith. DJing, it never occurred to me that it could take my faith away. Yeah, although I was trying to get a new definition for life and give it a new perspective because of what had happened. I know so many people who never went back to church because of the role of the church in the genocide. our friends who said, no, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? Telling me to go to church. To do what? If the priests and the bishops, you know, killed their own flock, nothing means anything to me. Christmas, okay, but I'll celebrate in my own way, you know. I won't go to church, but I'll celebrate. Foodstuffs and drinks, and that is, it's Christmas. But with me, the Christmas minus prayer is not full, it's not complete.
And when you look at your country now, what it's become now, 18 years after the genocide, do you still recognise something of the spirit of that Christmas 94, everybody coming together to forget the past and to look to the future?
Exactly, yeah, because actually tremendous steps have been made to kind of reconcile and promote unity among the Rwandans themselves. And at the moment, Rwandans are too prayerful. Not to say that they go to the Catholic Church for the Christmas, no, but rather they hold vigils, night vigils, like on the 24th, at all stadia in the country, expect at least a service for Christmas, first of all. And then it should not be more than 2 hours, people to renew their faith, to give it, you know, the importance it deserves. And then people will hit the club immediately, especially the youth.
But you're not there anymore today.
I'm not there, but, you know, I'm here and born, and I will celebrate the same way, you know, the African way. Yeah, probably go for a service, and then after, you know, go, you know, party, you know. And
I can imagine you on the dance floor.
Yeah.
Have you got quite a reputation in Bonn?
Well, where I go, they know me. They know Isaac the dancer. Avenue. Watch this. Big thing I want for know what this fans
build up John. You hear that? It's a pity we're in Rage, otherwise we'd be seeing those moves right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, really.
It's been a pleasure having Isaac the journalist come into the studio and relive the past of Isaac the DJ.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah, thank you too for having me here.
Thanks, Isaac. You go by, and a lot of brothers try, but you ain't even say hi, as they promise you the world just to be a lover. But you ain't trying to hear when they kiss the willy mother. The quickest way to the point is walk a straight line. Let us be friends, not a possession of mine. You see, slow or swift, I shift into gear, able to adjust and play it by ear. Patience is a virtue, virtue is a grace. Before I touch your waist, I put a smile on that face. Talk real candid, but I won't go too far. Besides you, where it hurts, and things like that are kind of fun loving with a bogus charm.
You're listening to DW's World Link, where I'm Neil King.
And I'm Kate Laycock. The mistletoe hangs here and there for lovers to lose all their cares and kiss the ones they want the most when Christmas comes around. This is a special time of year. With all those wishes you can hear, it's not the gifts that matter most when Christmas comes around. Many people don't believe or share our Christmas cheer, but then again, it just doesn't matter, so join in.
You're listening to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories from behind the headlines. In Bonn, I'm Neil King.
And I'm Kate Laycock. Still to come on our Christmas show, what if suddenly, overnight, all your neighbours became millionaires and you were left to carry on just as before?
What if, instead of raising money for Africa this Christmas, you were to help those poor, shivering people in Norway?
It's kind of just as bad as poverty, if you ask me. Sunlight puts smiles on people's faces. People don't ignore starving people, so why should we ignore cold people? Frostbite kills too. Africa, we need to make a difference in Norway. We need to collect our radiators, ship them over there, and spread some warmth, spread some light, and spread some smiles. Say yes to Radiate.
Those and more stories coming up on World Link. But first, Neil, what do you say to this? Oh, Christmas tree, how lovely are your branches. They all look green in wintertime. They all look green in Jamaica's sunshine.
I think you might have got it a bit mixed up, Kate.
And I didn't sing it either, did I? What a cop-out. But the reason that I was saying that to you is because Jamaica may be a Caribbean island, but that does not mean that it can't give colder countries, like Norway, coming up later, a run for its money when it comes to producing festive fir trees. And no, before you ask, they're not plastic. Confused?
Carry on.
Well, that's pretty much the reaction that Nick Davis had in Kingston when he came across them for the first time.
Santa Claus is going to town.
In the hustle and bustle of Kingston, just off the busiest road in the capital, street sellers, or higglers as they're known, have a variety of Christmas-themed products for sale. Despite the heat, there's rosy-faced Santa Clauses in the supermarkets and people buying up litres of sorrel juice, a fruit drink sold mainly in the festive season. It's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas. Oh, and unlike most things that are imported into this tropical island, the Christmas trees by the side of the road are real, not plastic, and grown locally. From stubby ones around 3 foot to towering monsters bought by corporations to mark the festive season, their journey starts about 5,000 feet up in the foggy blue mountains that begin where Kingston ends.
The road's getting to Penlyon Castle, a rough to say the least. Pretty much most of the people here go up and down the hills in four-wheel drive vehicles. The actual countryside is stunning, it's glorious. It's mountains as far as the eye can see.
I wonder up here the best Christmas tree that grew, you know. You see, up here is the best part in the world that could grow.
Sonny Brown is a farmer up here. In his hands is a machete that he's used to pick and fill a sack of avocados from his fields. The mountainsides are covered in fog, the air cool, ideal for coffee and Christmas trees.
Is the coffee there? They plant a lot of coffee up here, a lot of people pick it and all them things, and then get a lot of money and all the way. They then pick it like all $1,000 and all the way and all, so.
The infamous Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee.
Yeah. And it's very nice, you know. Yeah, beat it all in a mortar and all them things there.
So you beat it in a mortar and then from that, that's how you actually get this highly expensive Jamaican Blue Mountain coffee. It's a way of life in the Blue Mountains. Life is pretty hard here, and what they plant is barely enough to survive on and sell, but Christmas trees make a difference. How long does it take to grow?
Well, it takes like about 3 months. It can work out to a year, though, 1 year. We finish it up and all that thing. Sometimes they prune it up, and then depends on how they sell it. Sometimes it takes all 2 years.
Over the course of the year, the farmers prune the trees, cutting the wild conifers into the traditional Christmas tree shape before market.
At Christmas time, people get happy and set it up with some bulb and all them things around the yard and all them way. Yeah. And then round and then it carry to the market or sell it. Then sell it upon price, like $1,000, $3,000 and all them way there.
So they sell for, on average, between $10 and $30, a good profit for all concerned.
As we make our way back down to Kingston, we're in a convoy with farmers, and they're all in their Land Rovers. The one in front of us has Christmas trees poking out of everywhere. There must be about 15 of them, and I don't know how they all fit in.
We have been selling here for a long time, you know, man. Like 30-odd years we sell here. Yeah, so people get to know we, and we have a customers, one and two customers.
Yeah, how
are
you doing?
Yeah, how are you doing?
Okay.
Yeah, so how much is the Christmas tree?
We have 2,000.
2,000 uppers.
Yeah,
mountain.
And I might just decorate it with shells or the color of the Jamaica, because
you can carry it away too. You can export it away straight abroad.
Christmas is a time of celebration and bring forth light.
It's better natural because it actually grow up. So anything, it's better than the artificial.
We wish you a reggae Christmas. We wish you a reggae Christmas. We wish you a reggae Christmas and a reggae New Year.
Nick Davis on the trail of Made in Jamaica festive greenery there.
Well, Christmas is marked in many different ways in different parts of the world. For Christians, it's a time to remember the birth of Christ in Bethlehem. For others, the celebrations are linked to the winter solstice or even paganism. But what about a country and culture where there are none of those links? Do they still get caught up by the Christmas bug? Yoshi Matsumoto is in Kyoto to find out.
December the 25th is not an official holiday in Japan. Only half of 1% of Japanese people are Christians, and many do not understand the roots of the festivities marked by people in other countries.
Is it the birthday of Jesus? I'm not sure. Is it the birth of Jesus Christ? Or is it the day Jesus Christ was reborn? I'm sorry, but I don't know much about it.
Japan is a mainly Buddhist or Shinto country. Despite this, though, we are big lovers of celebrations and festivals, including Christmas. I'm in Kyoto, ancient capital of Japan, and the city of castles and temples. I've come to one of the biggest shopping centers in town to find out how people are preparing for Christmas Day. The majority of people will be going to work or school on December 25th, but they do make time for some festivities.
I hope my boss doesn't give me overtime. I see you go to university in Kyoto. Do you spend Christmas with your friends or boyfriend? With friends, or I will come home. So you haven't planned for Christmas Day yet? It's not actually a holiday, is it? Yes, I'll still be going to university on the 25th. So, what are you planning for Christmas?
I will hang around the city centre.
What for? I'll go to the anime shop.
Christmas in Japan is about couples and relationships rather than the extended family.
I think it's wonderful if you can be with someone you love warmly. So, do you have a plan for Christmas Day? For now I haven't decided. Will you be exchanging presents? Yes, we're just talking about it.
Christmas is seen as a time for romantic miracles with slightly expensive cute presents exchanged, including teddy bears, rings, flowers, and scarves. I guess it's a bit like Valentine's Day in some other countries.
How do you perceive Christmas in other parts of the world? I have an image of going to church and singing carols. They go to church and be with their family and quietly have a big meal. And there's a fireplace and so on.
Eating stollen and chicken.
We Japanese have an unusual take on the traditional roast dinner.
What do you eat at Christmas?
Chicken. Chicken, such as KFC. Roast chicken. And I also have strawberry shortcake. And I often drink sparkling wine.
It's become a tradition on Christmas Eve to eat cake. Often strawberry shortcake, which is usually bought by the father of the family on his way home from work. The shortcake can be very expensive because the price of strawberries rises to keep up with the demand. Meanwhile, a big food retailer has employed heavy TV advertising to make Christmas synonymous with its products in Japan.
We eat a full course meal for dinner. We eat KFC.
Lots of Japanese people now think chicken is more about Christmas than turkey. The advertising around Kentucky Fried Chicken has become so strong that many Japanese pre-book their chicken dinner meals well in advance of Christmas Day. So, if cake and chicken have become a part of the Japanese Christmas, how many Christmas songs and carols have found their way to Kyoto City?
Makana ohana no tonakai-san wa
For Japanese people, Christmas is a special day for spending the precious night with family, friends, or anyone you care for, and showing how strong your love is. Most people in Japan don't seem to understand the real meaning of Christmas, but still, they really appreciate Christmas time and feel very happy to hear the word Christmas.
Yoshi Matsumoto reporting from Kyoto there.
Now, tis the season to get rich, or if you're living in Spain, it is. And that is because this year marks the 200th anniversary of Spain's Christmas lottery, a tradition which goes hand in hand with the holiday season for most Spaniards. Across the country, families gather to watch the televised broadcast of the draw, and as Spaniards struggle with soaring unemployment and austerity measures, the world's richest lottery offers a tantalising piece of hope. But for one village in northwest Spain, the idea of winning, or not winning the lottery, has taken on a completely different meaning. Ashifa Qasim brings us this report.
Oblivious to the crowds pushing against him in this tiny bar, Kostis Michotekis fiddles with the lens of his video camera. He zooms in, then out and in again. Finally, he sits back, satisfied. After a lifetime searching for the perfect project, the 43-year-old filmmaker has finally found it.
Starting analyzing a little bit, I'm saying this is an amazing story.
But it didn't come easily. In fact, it started with a bout of incredibly bad luck. His film takes place in the sleepy little town of Sodeto. It's a Spanish village untouched by time, where kids play in the main street, darting between rows and rows of stone houses. One year ago, this tiny farming village found out they had won first prize in the world's richest lottery.
The whole town was celebrating. Everybody was hugging each other, kissing each other. It was great. I get goosebumps just thinking on that moment, you know.
Sandra Garcia del Pozo was one of the lucky winners. There were 1,800 first prize tickets, and most of them wound up in the hands of Sodeto residents. They had each won a piece of a jackpot worth 700 million euros. Sandra's share came out to 100,000 euros, but she's quick to point out that most of her neighbors won more than her. Much more.
I'm the poorest in this town right now.
Overnight, Sodeto went from a struggling village of farmers and unemployed construction workers to one filled with millionaires.
I didn't sleep. I didn't manage to sleep for the next 3 months, I think. But you couldn't believe it. It was like in Sodeto. Like nobody knows where Sodeto is in Spain. We're a tiny village. And suddenly we became the center of the world. So it was all surreal in a way, very surreal.
Of the 70 families who call Sodeto home, every single house in the village had a winning ticket. Except one. Remember filmmaker Kostis Michotekis?
I got a phone call from my friend and neighbor that he was on the train to Madrid. So he says to me, something is going on in Sodeto, something about the lottery. Yeah, right, okay. So I just got the car, I drove to the village, and I saw everybody in the street shouting, screaming, champagne bottles open, cars beeping, chaos broke loose. I mean, everybody was having a party. Everybody.
The filmmaker inside of him stirred, and he went home to get his video camera.
At the beginning, I was having the feeling that they are all overreacting, because I thought that they are talking about 5,000-10,000 euros. What does it mean, a ticket, I was saying? He says, the minimum is 100,000. Whoa. Okay. They are talking about big money here.
It took a little while before it hit him. He was the only one in his village who hadn't won the lottery.
The same day, I didn't even realize it, that I didn't have. But the next afternoon, you don't have a ticket. It was funny. It was actually funny.
The town's homemakers association had gone door to door selling the winning series of tickets. There was only one house they didn't visit, Costis's house, which sits about a kilometer outside the village.
At the beginning, I was thinking, what would I have done if I had also a ticket or had won the lottery? But in a way, I think that it was like a destiny thing.
He was the outsider, the one who didn't win, but he was also a filmmaker and the insider who knew everybody in town. He set out to document how money would change life in his tiny village. His camera was rolling as slick salesmen and desperate bankers descended on Sodeto.
They brought a Jaguar. They put it in the center of town. I like to show it off. And actually it was funny because I remember a guy just walking there looking at the Jaguar. It was a 250,000 euros car. Looking at it very seriously, and suddenly he says, bring me a tractor. What do I do with a Jaguar?
Instead, many invested in top-of-the-line farming equipment or paid off their mortgages. And there was one other trend. Home renovations took off big time.
For a period of time, you couldn't drive inside because there were so many working people and trucks and cranes. This was like crazy.
With all that money floating around town, lottery winner Sandra Garcia del Pozo worried about greed and envy.
When we won the lottery that day, I was thinking, oh my God, today is going to change so much. Okay, maybe we do talk like, oh, that one got 1 million and did this or did that or wants to do that. You know, you do talk about that because it's normal. But we carry on doing the same. People hasn't really changed. They haven't even, people with a lot of money now, they haven't even stopped working 16 hours a day.
It wasn't long before Costis started to wonder, why hadn't life changed more in Sodeto?
This is also the game that we're going to have with the film. What do you do with that? Why do you don't go away? Why you don't travel? Why you don't do you have dreams? How is it possible that you don't have big dreams? You know, dreams that you knew that there's no way you're going to do them otherwise.
The residents of Sodeto do have one dream. They liked winning the lottery so much that they want to do it again. They bought triple the number of tickets this year. And if they win, they're making sure Costis won't be left out.
This year I got him too, and I say, you got them.
But if you ask Sandra, Costis won't be needing those lottery tickets. His luck came last year, the year he didn't win the lottery.
His world is the images and the movies and the documentaries, and for him that makes him rich. He doesn't need money. This is what makes him alive. And he got a great story now to be able maybe to do the movie of his life and to be successful on that. And I think that will be his lottery, for sure, and it will be much better than ours.
Sodeto entera se va de borrachera. Sodeto entera se va de borrachera.
And as we go to air with Ashifa Qasim's report, the numbers are still to be drawn in that lottery. So did Costis get lucky? WorldLink may never know.
Do they know it's Christmas time at all?
That is, of course, Band-Aid's number one hit single, Do They Know It's Christmas? Now, this charity appeal launched by Bob Geldof and Co. in 1984 brought together an impressive range of pop stars in a bid to raise money for famine relief in Africa. Recently, a new Band-Aid-style video has been released, which is altogether different. It's a parody dubbed Radi-Aid, which went viral on YouTube. And it has a completely different take on who is needy these days. Just listen for yourself.
Radiate.
Now, this video is far more than a mere Band-Aid parody, according to the man behind it. That is Eric Schreiner Evans, the head of SAIH, the Norwegian Students and Academics International Assistance Fund. Now, contrary to the impression given by the video, SAIH is a serious organisation that supports development projects in countries such as Zimbabwe, South Africa, Zambia, Bolivia and Nicaragua. So why poke fun at Band-Aid, you may well ask? Earlier, I spoke with Eric, who told me more about the video, its message, and why he's sick and tired of Band-Aid.
We want to really mess with the stereotypes that people have. We've been rather frustrated with the way that the media and certain fundraising initiatives portray countries in the Global South, especially Sub-Saharan Africa. They keep repeating this constant narrative of Africa more as one country filled with nothing but, you know, war, poverty, starvation. And Africa is so much more than that.
Now, as you just said, the video is a parody of the well-known Band-Aid charity appeals in which Western musicians came together to raise money for Africa. Now, your video shows freezing Norwegians battling snowy and windy conditions while people in sunny Africa are collecting radiators to send to Norway. Why did you choose this ironic approach to get your message across?
We're trying to make it to visualize in an easy way how really ridiculous it is to sort of just think of Africa as poverty, war, starvation, because although it is a problem, it's a lot more than that. And same thing with Norway. The weather can sometimes be a problem, but, you know, there's a lot more to Norway than just cold weather. And I also think there's a need for more, you know, for people to laugh more. We need a happier message. All these negative images that were being served, you know, day in and day out, I think people are perhaps growing a bit tired of them.
Have you by any chance had any reaction from Bob Geldof, the mastermind behind Band-Aid?
No, we haven't. You know, actually, I would love to talk to him about this.
What would you tell him?
To stop.
And why would you tell Bob Geldof to stop?
Although he is doing a good job in many ways, he does important work. I think he should abide by the principle of do no harm. He is, and this is not in no way just Bob Geldof. This is a lot of initiatives, but they give people the option of, first they shock people with horrible images and a problem, and then they give them the option of actually doing something by donating to this and this account number. And of course, people are good; they want to help out, so they donate. But what they're failing to tell and show to people is that the problem that they donate to fix is just a symptom of greater problems. There are structural problems. The problems are in many ways caused by European and North American agricultural policies, foreign policies, trade policies. And in addition to just donating, because we should keep donating, we should also start demanding change from our political leaders. I think that would have a much greater effect.
Are you worried that your video could hamper the efforts of charity organizations trying to raise money for impoverished African regions?
You know what? I think they're doing that on their own, really. By using these shock images over and over, you can open up people's wallets on the short term. But I think people also grow tired. I mean, we've been doing aid now for decades, and if you keep being served the same problem over and over, it seems like none of the things we've been doing for all these years has actually had any effect. And you know, that's untrue. A lot of things have worked, and things are looking a lot brighter now than they were, at the time of Band-Aid.
Eric, if we talk about the actual making of the song, how did you go about producing it, and who features in the video?
The people actually featuring in the video are mostly volunteer students in Durban, South Africa. It was really a huge effort done by a lot of people with little or no funding, really. People in Norway, there's a band called Bretton Woods actually wrote the lyrics. A guy, South African, called Watik Hussein composed the music. And then it was produced by a company called iKind in South Africa. But there's been a lot of other people involved as well, of course. I think a lot of people sort of caught on to this idea. They were really, when we presented the idea, they were rather enthusiastic. People want to challenge the stereotype that a lot of people have, especially people, with a background from Africa. Because I have the impression that a lot of people are actually rather offended by these negative stereotypes.
So how many radiators have you collected so far, and have there been any takers in Norway?
Well, you know what? funny enough, that there has been some attempts to actually donate radiators to us. Not everybody seemed to get the irony, although most people did.
Given the success of the video, Eric, where are you taking this campaign? Will we be seeing another parody next year, or was this just a one-off?
Right now, we just set up a little shop on the web so people can purchase the T-shirts. But once this calms down a bit, we really have to sort of just reassess the situation and see where we'll go next. This took us a bit by surprise, to be honest.
That was Eric Schreiner-Evans of SAIH and the mastermind behind the Norway for Africa charity appeal video. Well, our show is drawing to a close fast, but this being a Christmas show, we simply had to have something from a traditional German Christmas market. Now, believe it or not, I haven't actually got round to going this year, but I know for a fact that you, Kate, are one of the regulars at Bonn's Christmas market, isn't that so?
It's all lies, Neil, all lies.
What? And you're off for some more Glühwein tonight, I heard.
That's true, but in Düsseldorf. If you see me around, I'll be the one with the red nose and the antlers.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
As we seem to have established, I am indeed a fan of German Christmas markets, but I am not the only one. Our reporter Camille Grayson has also been sipping Glühwein at Siegburg's Christmas market. And whilst she was there, she got out her microphone and asked people what they're wishing for this Christmas. There's just one condition, though. It's got to be something that money cannot buy. Here's what people said.
No war. Only answer I can give, because it's the only crank stuff that's going on right now. And Israel and all the stuff going on around this North Africa and South Africa. It's hard to understand this relationships between these religions. And that's the only one which I wish me for Christmas, because money isn't worth for it.
Well, think like food for others. And, you know, I'm a vegan, so I would like to have other people become vegan and have less animals exploited. Guess that's about it. And I would like to have the problems in the Middle East solved, because it's a big problem.
I would suggest peace for all the people, and that things will come to a better end next year.
Free time, not work.
Nice evenings with the family. And with the boyfriend.
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, to be together with the family. And, to eat nice things. Yeah, just to be calm and silent and friendly together.
I hope my child is well, and we will meet his grandparents, and I hope they will have a good time with him.
What I wish you for Christmas... I don't know. Nothing. I'm happy. Nothing special.
And a happy man bringing us to the end of our show there. Now, Kate, I have a little something for you here.
Oh, it's present time.
It's present time. Let me just open my bag and hand this over. There you go. Hang on. I'm just going to slide it across.
Oh, okay. It's coming in a...
Oh, there you go.
A Tupperware lunchbox. Wow. Have you been baking?
Well... I must admit, it wasn't
baking.
Actually me, it was my wife. If I'd been baking, I wouldn't be handing this over.
Oh, this is really exciting. These are Plätzchen.
Those are...
German Christmas biscuits.
Yes, Plätzchen, yeah.
Plätzchen.
And those are Vanillekipferl you've got there.
Oh.
And the other ones are called Pflaumenstangen.
Wow.
They've got chocolate on the ends, and inside there's marzipan with plum jam.
Unluckily for our studio team, however, they look far too good to share. So that's good news for me, Kate Laycock, but bad news for you, Neil King.
Yeah. Nancy Eisenson.
Camille Grayson.
And our technician, Erhard Bürger, although I'm pretty sure when we come out of the studio, if Kate hasn't scoffed them all down, we'll have some for Erhard too.
Play your cards right, Erhard.
And now it's time to say goodbye and wish all our listeners a very happy Christmas. We hope you enjoyed our Christmas show, and will be humouring us again next week when it's time for a fun New Year's special. And don't forget that if you want to listen to any of the items in the programme, you can always check out our website at dw.de/worldlink,
or look us up on iTunes. WorldLink is brought to you by DW in Bonn.